Okay, thank you very much. So I'm going to be talking about, as the title says, holographic entanglement entropy, and in fact, holographic Rainey entropies as well. This is all work that I've done with this list of smart people down here. In particular, I'll point out Janet. Her postdoc application will be appearing in a web upload site or an email box near you very soon. So there are two separate papers there, and there are lots more details than I'll be able to tell you about. In any event, in this workshop, I'm sure you've seen a lot of titles like this: holographic superconductors, holographic superfluids, holographic Fermi surfaces. And in all of them, what we're doing is we're taking some great idea and we're trying to merge it with ADS-CFT. But I should start then by telling you what that great idea is in this particular case. So what is entanglement entropy? Well, it's a very general tool. And what one does is you take a quantum system, divide it into two pieces, and then you use entropy as a measure of the correlations between the different pieces of our system. In the context that we're talking about today, we're going to be talking about quantum field theories. And so the way that we divide the system is we take a Cauchy surface or a constant time slice, and we just introduce a boundary here that splits that surface into two pieces. I'm going to use the nomenclature that that boundary is called the entangling surface, just because in a holographic talk, boundary is already taken for other purposes. So here's our entangling surface. What we do is we integrate out the degrees of freedom, say in the outside. That leaves us with a density matrix describing the degrees of freedom that are left over in there. And then we just calculate the von Neumann entropy. So we take trace rho log rho, throw in a minus sign, and that's what we call entanglement entropy. Now there's a slight problem here in that if we actually succeeded in doing that, we would find that the answer is infinite. And that's because the entropy is actually dominated by short distance correlations near our entangling surface. And so to make sense of the calculation, we have to regulate it, and so I'll do that by introducing a short distance regulator or a short distance cutoff that is going to be called delta, and that'll be running through the entire talk. If we introduce a cutoff like that, then rather than infinity, we get an expression like this where there are various power laws. The D here, for me, is the total number of space-time dimensions. So I'm counting time when I count up to D. This first power then turns out to be the area in that number of dimensions. And if you look a little more closely, in fact, what you find is you can express this as the area of the entangling surface over the cutoff, multiplying some particular coefficient, dimensionless coefficient. A problem, though, is that if we take a look at these, those coefficients are all sensitive to the details of the regulator. So if I do the calculation, my grad student does the calculation, we may get different answers here. And so a simple way to see that is that if we change the cutoff by some numerical factor, certainly those coefficients are changing. However, if we persist in carrying out this expansion at higher orders, we can typically find that there is some kind of universal information. So for example, you might find that there's a logarithm appearing in that expansion, and that coefficient here then would give us some kind of information that's universal that characterizes the underlying field theory that we're describing here or calculating for. Some more general comments. Well, entanglement entropy is telling us about correlations. It's a non-local quantity, which I say here is at best difficult to measure. I say that because there is no procedure or accepted experimental procedure by which I can ask my friend to go to the lab and measure the entanglement entropy. However, as theorists, that doesn't stop us from thinking about entanglement entropy or using entanglement entropy. In condensed matter theory, it's a useful diagnostic still to characterize different critical points or topological phases of matter. In quantum information theory, this is a useful measure of quantum entanglement, where that entanglement provides a resource. It's a computational resource. I'll also remind some of us who've been around for a while that we've actually seen entanglement entropy in discussions of black hole physics way back when. Remember that I said that there was an area law, that the first term here, we had an entropy that went like an area, and that sounds kind of like black hole entropy, where we also have an entropy of the horizon going like the area of the horizon. In particular, if that cutoff happened to be about the Planck scale, then this expression would look very much like the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy of a black hole. And this is an idea, actually, that goes way back to 86, but Mark over there, I think, independently discovered it in the 90s, and there was a long discussion about those kinds of ideas. And then, most recently, about 5 years ago, I'll add that entanglement entropy came into the discussion of holography, or the ADS-CFT correspondence. So what do we have there? Well, ADS-CFT gives us a quantum field theory, namely the boundary conformal field theory, and so we might want to calculate entanglement entropy. We might think of that picture as living in our conformal field theory. To really make use of the correspondence or to make use of holography, though, what I want to do is I want to turn the calculation into a geometric calculation or a gravitational calculation. So I should think that our diagram here lives at r equals infinity on the ADS boundary, and in this cartoon I can think that the rest of the bulk, or the rest of the ADS, lives down here underneath that picture. And the question is, well, how do I think about the entanglement entropy in geometric terms, or gravitational, in terms of the gravitational theory? So Rue and Takanagi made this proposal, which was that I should think about a class of surfaces that hang down into the bulk, but they connect up to the same entangling surface, or that same surface sigma, out at the boundary. We evaluate the area, divide by 4 Newton's constant, and then we find the extremal value of this quantity for that particular class of surfaces, and that's what they said the entanglement entropy should be equal to. Some details here. One might wonder, well, why isn't the smallest area just going to be up here, flat across the top? It's only a small lie to say that the reason the surface hangs down here is because there's a gravitational potential in the ADS space that's pulling it down. And so the extremal area hangs down rather than getting sucked up or shrinking back to the boundary. I call this an area, but I'll remind you that we're in higher dimensions, and so if my boundary space-time is d dimensions, this area is actually a d minus 1 dimensional quantity. The other thing that we've stuck in here is 4 times Newton's constant, and that looks then like the black hole entropy, and so it has the right kind of flavor. However, again, we run into a problem. If I actually try and evaluate that area, I find that it's infinite for any one of those surfaces. However, that's not a bug, that's a feature. I told you that I should have expected the entanglement entropy to be infinite, and in fact it is, and it's something that I can associate with a UV divergence. Why is the area infinite? Well, it's because this lives out here at r equals infinity, and so if I insist on integrating all the way to infinity, I'm going to find an infinite amount of area there at large radius, which we associate with the UV degrees of freedom in the bulk. However, if the problem is integrating all the way to infinity, the way we solve that is by not integrating to infinity. Rather, we stop the integral at some large radius. We introduce a cutoff surface in the bulk space-time. Introducing that cutoff surface is like introducing a short distance cutoff in the boundary theory, or in the CFT. And so the larger the value of R0, the smaller the value of delta. I need a conversion constant, and that L squared is just the radius of curvature of my anti-de Sitter space. If I introduce a cutoff like that, then my answer starts by looking like this. What I find here is some expression with an appropriate power of my cutoff. In fact, that factor there is nothing but the area law that I mentioned before. So this is just the area of the entangling surface measured in the boundary metric. There's a coefficient here with the ADS scale and Newton's constant. That's really just the ADS scale to the Planck scale to some appropriate power. That's something that we can think of as counting the degrees of freedom in the boundary theory, or more specifically, if we add numerical factors, that becomes the central charge of the boundary theory. That's the first term. If we persist, we can do an expansion, and we find a series of power law terms as we did before. And if we work harder and harder, we'll eventually find that there are some universal contributions at high orders in these expansions. Now, I said that that was a proposal that Ryu and Takinagi put forward. It's a conjecture. It's not something that they derived. It has the right feel, perhaps, that looks like black hole entropy. But what we do in a situation like this is we test the idea against, various possibilities. And so by now, there's actually an extensive list of consistency tests of this proposal. The first one that I'll put on my list here is that we recovered the area law. A more interesting one is that two dimensions is actually a place where we have more control, or in fact, for two-dimensional conformal field theories, we have a lot of symmetry and we can calculate, or rather, these gentlemen calculated for us. And what they did is they came up with a very nice expression for what I should expect the entanglement entropy to be. And so if I have periodic boundary conditions, that means a spatial slice or a t equals zero slice is just a circle of some circumference. I'm choosing an interval of length L in there. And what I find is what they found is the entanglement entropy takes this form. So there's a lot of geometric stuff in there. Here's our cutoff delta. There's a logarithm in two dimensions. And then the coefficient there is nothing but the central charge of my two-dimensional conformal field theory. So that's a universal result that applies for any conformal field theory. And as I said here, I can do this calculation in three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space, and I get this result bang on the nose. There are lots of other tests that I could talk about, but I won't. In some lists that I made up at some point, there are two that I will mention because they're work that I did recently in the past year. So there's a connection to central charges, and then there's this derivation down here. So what is the connection to central charges? Well, we saw in two dimensions that there was this logarithmic contribution that was proportional to the central charge. And there's a nice story that persists even in higher dimensions. As long as I'm in an even number of dimensions, there's a trace anomaly. So what does that mean? That means ordinarily I think that my conformal field theory has a traceless stress tensor. However, if I put the theory in a curved space-time, I'll find that rather than getting zero, I get some geometric factors on this side. So in four dimensions, there are two contributions, Weyl tensor squared and something that looks like this combination of curvatures. And so there are two independent coefficients known as the central charges, C and A, for any conformal field theory. Now, there's a story that I'm not going to tell you, but it's been developed by, a number of people, including these, that the logarithmic contribution to the entanglement entropy is connected through the trace anomaly to these particular central charges, or whatever central charges appear in higher dimensions. So in our four-dimensional result, here is the universal contribution. Here's our logarithm. There's an integral over the entangling surface. And then there's some geometric stuff. There's both geometry of the background. So this is the Weyl tensor of the background in which the conformal field theory lives. And there's also geometry of the entangling surface. So this is the intrinsic curvature or curvature scalar of that surface. These are extrinsic curvatures of that surface. And so you do those integrals, and that gives you some, that geometry determines some linear combination of central charges.
This is a field theory result.
This is all field theory, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Some free field theory calculation?
No, you can. There's an argument that I can tell you about afterwards where you use the trace anomaly to derive that. Yeah. Which is only a small lie, which I'll tell you about afterwards. However, it turns out that the Ryu and Takinagi proposal recovers precisely this expression. So that means that I have a five-dimensional ADS space. I can choose any smooth entangling surface, and I will get exactly this geometric expression multiplying the logarithm. There's one small caveat that implicitly we're talking about Einstein gravity in the bulk there. And for Einstein gravity, I can't distinguish these two central charges. There's nothing wrong with that. That's saying I've got a certain class of conformal field theories where those two coefficients are the same, but I'm still reproducing all of that interesting geometry. However, we do know that if I include R squared terms in the bulk, then I can start to distinguish these two charges. And so in certain higher curvature theories, the details of which I'm never going to tell you in my talk, but I'll label it Gauss-Bonnet gravity or GB gravity, it turns out you can reproduce this expression down to the fine details of also having a C where there's supposed to be a C and an A where there's supposed to be an A. One thing is that the bulk action is corrected or changed by higher curvature terms. The functional that I'm extremizing in this Ryu Takinagi proposal also gets a higher curvature correction as well. That's a theme that I'm going to be using over in this talk, namely that we can talk about the merits of whether or not we should be using these higher curvature theories, but what I'll say is that if there is a simple result that is true for any CFT, such as this, then it will be true of these higher curvature theories. And so that's something that we'll look at, or we'll see actually, well, yes, we'll see later on in the talk.
So that formula, is it derived from like a Wald-type entropy?
That formula is not derived from a Wald-type formula.
So how do you make it?
That's a whole other talk, and it's a talk I gave at McGill in August. So I'll remind you about it afterwards. Okay, so that's a nice connection. Some things to remember there are central charges for CFTs. We'll see lots of central charges appearing in different places later on. And also this idea of using higher curvatures to distinguish those central charges in the boundary theory. But what I wanted to focus on next was this derivation of holographic entanglement entropy that we wrote about in this paper at the beginning of the year. So before we talk about what we did, we should understand, or I should give you a flavor of why it's hard to derive holographic entanglement entropy. And that goes back to a standard approach, or quote unquote, the standard approach, which relies on something called the replica trick, where what one does is first calculates the Rényi entropy. So working with logarithms is hard. It's easier to work with powers of the density matrix. And so there's a set of entropies known as the Rényi entropies, where I take trace of certain powers, add a logarithm and an extra factor. And those are expressions that are somewhat easier to deal with. However, with that precise expression, you can see, or one can convince yourself, that in the limit n goes to 1, I can recover, I recover exactly the entanglement entropy. However, if you go into the details of the replica trick, you'll see that what you're doing is a path integral in the quantum field theory over a singular geometry. It's a singular n-fold cover of the background space-time where the quantum field theory lives. Now, I hope that's an idea that's familiar to many of you in this room. If you are not familiar with that idea, come ask me after the talk, because there's a beautiful set of 5 slides that got edited out this morning that explain that point. But I thought why I better invest my time in other topics. Now, in holography or in the ADS-CFT, the slogan is, everything is geometry, but clearly this is going to be a problem if there are singularities already in the boundary. That's going to lead us, or naively it leads us, to thinking about singularities in the dual gravity description, but we don't really know how to work with those singular geometries. Perhaps if we work hard and we understand how to deal with string theory or quantum gravity fully in our bulk space-time, we can resolve those singularities, but until that point, it doesn't seem to be in the cards. And so this gentleman tried dealing with those singularities in a naive way, but Matt showed us that in fact his answers, or those manipulations, gave us the wrong answers. So that's a warning. What we really need is to put this aside, and we need to think of another calculation of entanglement entropy, a calculation that has a simple translation in the holographic context. Yes. Yeah, that's the logic, sure. We'll comment on that. Yeah, I want to come up. We're going to set Ruin Takinagi aside, and I just want right now to think about what's another way to calculate entanglement entropy, a way that I might be able to translate in a simple way. And the way we're going to make progress, or the way we made progress, is by specializing. And so we thought about this particular calculation. Take a CFT in D dimensions, in flat space, and choose an entangling surface that's spherical in that geometry with a radius r. And then the goal is to calculate this quantity here. I specialized in two ways. One, I focused my attention on CFTs, and here I focused my attention on a spherical surface. Now, one of the first observations is that in fact the density matrix that you come up with here doesn't just tell me, say, about the physics on this slice in this region A. For example, it doesn't just tell me about correlators that I might calculate there. It tells me about physics in the entire causal domain here that I've drawn. So any point up here, time-like curves running backwards must run into A, and similarly going forward from the bottom cone. So this tells me a lot more than just things happening in that certain time slice. And so what that observation does is it takes our attention away from the time slice and focuses it on a region of the space-time. Since I have a CFT, I can now think about doing a conformal mapping of that region of space-time. And in particular, there's an interesting mapping that we came up with that takes this causal domain into a new space where I have time cross a hyperbolic slice. So all of the balls sitting inside my spheres turn into hyperbolic hyperplanes. Essentially, what that conformal mapping is doing is it's blowing everything out to infinity. So it's blowing this stuff out away. And so this becomes, if you like, a Penrose diagram for this particular geometry there now, after the conformal mapping. We started, though, with a problem that had a scale in it, namely the radius of the sphere. And this geometry, or that the physics of this problem, remembers about that scale because it gives us the curvature of our hyperbolic slices. It also tells us one other thing, or it sets one other scale. A remarkable fact is if I started in the vacuum here in flat space, I end up in a thermal bath in this geometry after the conformal mapping. And the temperature is set again by this scale R. So, well, now we can recognize that the density matrix we're after is, well, in this problem, it's a thermal density matrix. There's some mapping in my CFT that takes that to our original density matrix here. But these are unitary transformations, and the entropy doesn't really care. They drop out of this formula here. So the entanglement entropy that we were after originally is now the thermal entropy in this particular case.
Is there a sort of assumption in this thing? Because how do we know that the entropy of the space or the accelerated observer is actually the entanglement entropy? I mean, how do we know this? Is there some
Okay, let's try again. So, I have a CFT, I'm doing a conformal mapping. That means that operators in the first get mapped to another set of operators in the second. So here's an interesting operator, the density matrix. And there's some transformation that takes our original density matrix to the new density matrix. And then what I said is the unitary doesn't matter in that von Neumann calculation, and so the entropy equals the entropy. A conformal transformation. Right. So that's part of the transformation. Is I start with this finite domain here. One of the things that the conformal transformation does is it blows the sphere up to infinity. And so this now, this is the only part of the space that's left. I mean, the rest of the space is gone, yes. So there was a sphere here. There was the red circle. That's a ball, and that it was just a finite piece of R d minus one, and now it's become an infinite hyperbolic plane.
Can this be done for arbitrary?
No. Yeah, spheres were special. You can't do it. I mean, we can talk more about it, but
I think it's just that if you take a hyperbolic loading and you formally compact the bottom, you get the interior of a disk. So the sphere is that's what it starts with.
No, but I think what David's saying is I could have picked an arbitrary wiggly surface here. I can always find a conformal transformation that does that part. You know, if the only thing that was important was blowing off the stuff outside that region, you can always find a conformal transformation that does that. But you end up then with geometries that are time dependent. I don't know what the state of the theory is. And so it's much more complicated in general. The sphere was very, very special that I got something simple afterwards. Did Eva have a question? Well, we're not in the bulk. We're doing a conformal field theory calculation. We haven't introduced holography yet, although we'll do that in one transparency. So be patient. There's one extra technical detail I wanted to mention. I've got this transformation. I'm mapping one problem to another problem. I'm equating the two entropies. But in fact, I've got infinity equals infinity there. Both of those expressions are divergent. We talked about that for the entanglement entropy. It's also rather obvious for the thermal entropy that I've got a uniform thermal bath in an infinite space. And so if I sum up a constant entropy density over an infinite volume, I'm going to get a divergence here. So to make sense of that inequality, I'd better regulate it in a way that, preserves that inequality. But the conformal mapping tells us how to do that. I can just follow our original short distance or UV cutoff in the original entanglement entropy problem to an IR cutoff, where it now becomes a maximum radius to which I would integrate the entropy density in this particular case. And so the conformal mapping tells me precisely how to do that, and in some coordinate system there's some simple relation like that where the maximum radius is just inversely proportional to the cutoff. And so it's in that sense that I have an equality here after I've regulated. Okay. So what I've done here is a story just about field theories, or conformal field theories in particular. However, in general, what I've done is taken one hard problem and mapped it to another hard problem. And so we haven't made that much progress. However, now we're going to think about holography. In holography, there's an extra entry in the dictionary that I can use. Namely, if I see thermal bath in the boundary theory, I can think black hole in the bulk space-time. And so I can actually extend that set of equalities I'm going to have entanglement entropy equals thermal entropy equals the horizon entropy of some black hole. All I have to do is find the right black hole for this particular problem. And in fact, there is a set of black holes that are appropriate. And the clue comes from this hyperbolic place or space here. There are, in fact, so-called topological black holes where the horizon is a hyperbolic space. And those horizons actually reach out all the way to the boundary of the ADS space, in some sense. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to, well, it turns out that the appropriate problem is to find the right black hole and then stick it in the space so that its horizon just connects up with the boundary region of interest. That's, so that's the region for which we wanted to calculate the entanglement entropy. However, perhaps as Eva was anticipating, it's a little simpler than that. In fact, the black hole that I want is just a particular foliation of empty ADS space. So here's empty ADS space in some coordinate system that we all recognize. Here's empty ADS space in another coordinate system that many of us will recognize. But in particular, you see now that GTT is going to zero somewhere. So it looks like a black hole. I can calculate the temperature associated with that horizon, and I find precisely T equals 1 over 2 pi r. Now, that shouldn't be perhaps too surprising. What we've done here is we've done a coordinate transformation in the bulk, but that coordinate transformation then implements the desired conformal transformation in the boundary theory. So that's an idea that we're familiar with, and so in some sense it had to work out that this temperature came out of the problem if we'd done this all correctly. However, a slogan that resonates with many people is, I should think that what I've done is essentially found a Rindler coordinate system or Rindler-like coordinates for ADS space. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking empty ADS here, the vacuum of my conformal field theory, and choosing some slicing that only looks at a piece of, that geometry, and namely focuses on this, this region here, this piece of the boundary is precisely that causal domain or that space H that we talked about in the conformal field theory discussion. Okay, so I can certainly apply these ideas in Einstein gravity, but as I foreshadowed before, we are going to think about it more generally, and I can think of basically any kind of gravity theory in the bulk. I have a handy formula, namely Wald's formula, that allows me to calculate horizon entropy for general covariant gravity theories. It's a formula that looks something like that. If you apply it in this particular problem, you'll get an expression that I've written out in this particular way. So there's some numerical factors out in front. There's a coefficient here with a funny name, AD star. In that dimensionless coefficient, I've packed all of the couplings of the gravity theory. So for example, for Einstein gravity, I find precisely the ratio of L, the ADS scale to the Planck scale to some power. In a more complicated theory of gravity, there's more junk that appears here. I've also chosen a particular normalization there, an annoying numerical factor, because with that normalization, this constant has a particular interpretation in terms of the boundary theory. So for even dimensions, that constant is precisely the central charge associated with the A-type trace anomaly. So it's a very particular central charge that appears in the trace anomaly. For odd dimensions, it defines an effective central charge that Aninda and I talked about recently in terms of various C theorems or possible C theorems. So that is that constant. We're still not done. There's this factor that I call V of the hyperbolic space. And the way I've presented it here, it's really the volume of a hyperbolic plane of unit curvature. What we're doing there is really integrating over the horizon, though.
Excuse me.
Yep.
Null dimensions is committed to a three-point function, or not? This A star says connected to the
Not going to be connected to a three-point, no. No. Unfortunately not. Or not, yeah, no. Oh, yeah, so I have to integrate. Remember, that's like the integral we were doing over the hyperbolic plane before. Here's an integral over the horizon. And so we have to go out to some maximum radius. I could use the prescription that we used, or that the conformal field theory told us about, or you can do something more interesting, which is to say that the original geometry or the original problem we had came with a regulator surface in the ADF. And so in our favorite coordinate system, that's just z equals delta. And so what we're going to do is we're going to integrate over the horizon up to the point where it touches that regulator surface. And if you do that, what you find is that U max is, in fact, precisely the same as we saw in the CFT. And so we're making that connection, though, in a geometric way here. This is nothing but the area law, the leading divergence. But if we persist, calculate to higher orders, we find some universal contributions. So there's the log for even dimensions, and there's a constant term for log for even dimensions, constant term for odd dimensions.
Rob, can you
remind
me why I should trust Walt's work
when
we get all this
subleading in powers of this R? I'm ask me down here. So what I did is some general comments. We can extend this whole discussion from flat space to global coordinates in the bulk, or where the conformal field theory lives on a cylinder. We can apply these ideas to Einstein gravity, and what you find is that the answers coincide with Ruin Takinagi's answers, and also that the horizon, or technically it's the bifurcation surface, coincides precisely with their choice of surface. However, one of the things to note is that there wasn't any extremization problem that I went through. And so the precise connection between our derivation and their proposal perhaps isn't so clear. This is Einstein gravity. I can think that I have some classical bulk theory that's not Einstein gravity but has some higher curvature terms like the Gauss-Bonnet. And you can just as easily apply this reasoning in those cases. If I had stringy corrections to my bulk action, I could apply those there as well. Another thing that you can do is you can imagine calculating quantum corrections, i.e. quantum stuff in the bulk now through the entanglement entropy. So for example, contributions of Hawking radiation. I stress the word imagine. However, I wouldn't have even known what I was going to think about calculating in the Ruin Takinagi proposal. They gave me a prescription. It picks out some surface, it's the saddle point of something, but I wouldn't have known how to ask this question, you know, what are the quantum corrections to that? And there were a bunch of questions. David?
What about the possibility of a sign, the entropy is negative in the finding part? Is there some clear answer to what that means?
That means there's a minus sign there? I don't know what you want.
Well, it's definitely positive.
Yes, and there are big positive numbers here.
Yeah, but the question is, so should we have some positivity somewhere?
I guess
that the true entropy is
possible, even
after strength.
No. Next question. Mark, you're happy or you're not happy?
Yeah, I guess I was confused. Somehow I wanted to equate expansions and powers of R with expansions and powers of H. I guess that this doesn't make any sense.
No. Not in this context, no. Aaron.
So is this thing only valid when the black hole is stationary? Because Weld's formula is only derived.
I'm only applying it to one very special black hole,
which is
a stationary black hole. Yeah. Gary.
Yeah.
So you said that you didn't have any extremization, so you're wondering what the connection is. But of course, you took the ruined Nakanagi surface and turned it into a horizon, which is an extremal surface. I mean, your surface is, of course, an extremal one. You didn't find it that way.
Yes. And that's why they match. And in fact, it's extremal in a very general way, in that I'm getting, I told you that for these higher or at least for a certain class of higher curvature theories, there was an extremization procedure, but I wasn't extremizing the area. But I would pick out exactly the same surface, so it's a very extremal surface.
The AD star is always polytropic.
AD star in the way I've defined it, yeah.
So the second line means in like 3D, 2 plus 1D, so we have this minus term, so kind of homologous band trip. And
It has the same sense. Yeah.
But how about the first term? So if D is 3, then that means...
D is even.
D is 2, so... But sometimes it can be negative, sometimes also.
Yeah. Was there another question? I urge you not to ask questions. We'll never get to the end. Oh, even? Sorry. Yeah. No. Nope. Moving right along. We can talk more afterwards, but I did want to tell you about the second paper where we did some calculations of Rainey entropies. So I mentioned them in passing before. They're close cousins of the entanglement entropy. What we look at there are powers of the density matrix, and we stick in factors so that when you take the limit n goes to 1, in fact, you recover the entanglement entropy. In this particular case, again, for fixed points and even dimensions, you might expect that there's a logarithmic contribution. Two dimensions, in some sense, sets the benchmark. Here again, Calabresi and Cardi have a very nice formula that takes this form, central charge, some numerical factor, and then the logarithm. But if we think about higher dimensions, there are actually very few calculations. And so can we ameliorate that situation by doing calculations using ADS-CFT? Well, again, we would run into this problem of having a singular covering space or singularities in the boundary calculation if we use the replica trick. But we had this other approach. So if we think about, I mean, we're focusing our attention now on spherical entangling surfaces. I told you this story where the density matrix was related to a thermal density matrix with a very particular temperature. And if I take powers of that and throw in a trace, I end up with an expression like this. So all I've really done by taking a power is change the temperature up here. And so this seems to be it seems that this approach is also very useful in thinking about Rainey entropies, especially in a holographic context. We work a little bit harder. You know, we had some partition functions at different temperatures, and so if we think about the free energy, the usual free energy, you get an expression here for what the Rainey entropy is. Again, we focused on CFTs and spherical surfaces. It's not that important, but using the usual F equal or entropy equals minus df by dt, you can change this formula into an integral of entropy over a range of temperatures there. So on this side, I've got the Rainey entropy. So that's what the goal was, to calculate the Rainey entropy for a spherical entangling surface. On this side, we've got the thermal problem. But it's a thermal problem in the hyperbolic geometry. But it's then something that I can easily translate to a holographic context. I just need to find, again, an appropriate set of black holes. But in this case, I can't just focus on a single temperature. I need to know about many different temperatures. And so I really need to know what all of the topological black hole solutions are. at arbitrary temperatures. And so we're going to have to focus our attention on various theories where we can actually calculate or where we know those solutions.
There's an issue with the denominator there, just the normalization previous one. So that temperature T naught over N. Before that one.
This one?
Yeah. The denominator, the transfer over the N.
Yeah.
Is it in the numerator, it's like temperature T naught over N?
Yeah. So there's a normalization factor. You might be familiar where you see, you know, Z of the cover and then Z of you know, without any singularities or branch cuts, but to the power N. So that's just reproducing that expression.
You're saying that's not a temperature T.
Oh, yeah, no. This is sort of, our normalization factor is still at T naught. It's only in the numerator here that we have the new temperature. So let's calculate Einstein gravity, four dimensions or a four-dimensional boundary. I get an expression like this. So there's some volume factor. Here's our ratio of scales. And then there's some numerical factor here that looks a little more complicated than we saw in two dimensions. You can translate that, you can pull out the universal expression. Here's the logarithm that came out of that. I've translated this into a central charge. And then there again, there's some numerical factor. If we compare it with what we saw in two dimensions, it sort of has the same flavor. There's a logarithm, a numerical factor, and a central charge. And so if we're optimistic, we might think that there's some kind of general form for this universal contribution in even dimensions that basically takes that form, central charge, numerical factor, logarithm. An issue, though, that immediately comes to mind is, well, this is Einstein gravity. What I told you is all of the central charges are equal in Einstein gravity. So which central charge should I really stick there? Well, we can't tell for this class of theories. But let's look at then Gauss-Bonnet. Then we get a slightly more complicated expression. Here's our logarithm, and then there are various numerical factors that mix up the C's and the A's in a very nonlinear way. And I'm not even telling you what X is explicitly. It's the root of some cubic equation. And there was a question. It does, doesn't it? It isn't. You can kind of see it in this expression when N goes to 1. X is actually going to 1 as well. And so that cancels between those two. details. 3 minus 2. OK, maybe I got that factor wrong. This is supposed to.
Anyway.
Everything is well behaved. Clearly, I didn't copy it down right. But one of the checks is, I mean, you can go back to this formula and, well, okay. Yes. Sorry, say again.
SM.
Oh, can I reproduce that? Sure. Yes.
So in that case, your circle, like you have the BPC interval,
so with a Yeah, there are lots of details I'm not telling you about. Can I tell you about it later again? I'm sorry. If you look at, I picked out d equals 4 to make things simpler, but you can actually write this out for arbitrary boundary dimension. And in fact, you can recover this result when you go to 2.
Okay.
What happens with that expression next time? Boundaries of the, you make a over c.
Excellent question. You'll get there in two transparencies. So You know, the slogan was, if there's something simple, holography will see it. Unfortunately, we're not seeing anything simple, and so it doesn't look, well, I would say there's no simple universal form that we should expect for entanglement entropy. And in fact, if you work harder, you find that this function actually depends on more data in the CFT than just the central charges appearing in the trace anomaly. And so in general, yeah, there's a big mess there. Very sad. However, here I have a very intimidating looking expression, and yet I can just, well, evaluate it and plot it out. And here it is. It doesn't look that intimidating anymore. So that had to be one, because what I'm doing is I'm normalizing everything with the entanglement entropy, and so S1 is the entanglement entropy. But as I increase the index, basically I get a curve where it's almost a straight line that drops down. And you had to expect that, because the Rainey entropies satisfy certain inequalities, and so they had to drop down like that. You were asking about the boundaries, and so this plot actually runs over only the allowed range of C over A. And so there's some undistinguished values over here.
What I was going to ask is, I mean, there's some reasons for the boundaries have something to do with free theories.
Okay.
Can you calculate the polynomial?
Oh, that's interesting.
Can you match this against free theories?
I haven't tried that. You could. I don't. Well, in principle, you could. Yeah.
Conjecture that the edges are just free theories.
Yeah. No. I understand. It's just whether or not the. I mean, free theory sounds really simple, but for this geometry, it's not clear to me how simple that calculation really is. But it's a possibility. So that looks actually very simple, and they look almost like straight lines. There's a problem with straight lines, which is that straight lines go down and down and down, and eventually they cross the axis zero. And it doesn't make sense to have negative entropy. However, you know, this is happening in that slide that I showed you. The holographic setup only really made sense in this range, or conformal field theories, as Diego taught us, should only have central charges that lie in this particular range. And then this negativity problem happens out here. However, if I go up in dimension, annoyingly what happens is that line crosses the boundary. And so here you're running into negative entropies, or negative Rainey entropies, in a region where I thought the holographic setup should make sense. So the real problem is that I'm using black holes where the black hole entropy can become negative at low temperatures in this particular class of Gauss-Binet theories. And so an obvious possibility is that what I've done is I've picked out some solution, but I've picked out the wrong solution. I've identified the wrong saddle point in this particular region. And so that's why I titled this phase transitions, because perhaps there is some kind of phase transition when we get into this region where the behavior of the entanglement entropy when n gets large changes, because I have to go to another saddle point. But there's a question mark there, you know, what is the right saddle point, or is it just that, you know, the holographic system doesn't make sense up there?
Well,
yeah?
A couple of questions ago, I asked you what happens when entropies are negative. You said it wasn't a problem, so now it's a problem.
Did I say that?
Yeah, but in some sense it was just a...
Yeah, no, this though is the leading term goes negative. I mean, here, if you like, if I'm thinking about the black holes, the entropy density is negative in this region. So is that okay? with 2 minutes and twist operator. So again, this may assume some background. Feel free to come and attack me afterwards, but please indulge me and let me run through this. We go back to the idea of the replica trick. Now, there I said that the reason the replica trick is the replica trick is we're going to evaluate this by doing a path integral over n copies of the field theory, but we're not just going to do n separate path integrals. We're going to let them talk to each other with these twist operators. What the twist operators do is they're inserted at the boundaries of our the region of interest, and they open up branch cuts where the fields in one copy talk to the fields in the next copy, and so on and so on. And if that didn't make sense, please ask me again afterwards. But that introduces the idea that there are operators in the conformal field theory or in the quantum field theory that play this role of connecting the different replicas in the replica trick. Again, D equals 2 sets the benchmark, or Cardi and Calabresi and Cardi set the benchmark by doing some elegant calculations. And so, for example, the scaling dimension of the twist operator in a two-dimensional CFT is given by this simple expression. The idea seems to extend in a natural way to higher dimensions. In higher dimensions, those twist operators become surface operators of a certain dimension, well, of the dimension of the entangling surface. But little is known about the properties of such operators when I think about higher dimensional problems. And so the question is, can we get some insight using holography? And the claim is yes, but I'm going to use two separate observations or two pieces of background. The first is, let's think about the correlator of the stress tensor with some surface operator or some twist operator. If the twist operator is a plane and I'm sitting in flat space, then the symmetry of the geometry, and implicitly I'm working with a conformal field theory, so conformal symmetry, conservation of the stress tensor, completely fix that expectation value. And it takes this form here, where there's a certain coefficient, and that would have been this scaling dimension in the two-dimensional problem. So that was the H that Cardi and Calabresi calculated. Yeah, there are various indices, some of them parallel to my surface operator, some of them orthogonal. So that's one piece of information. It says that I can find this coefficient in this correlator. Another piece of separate information, let's go back to our conformal mapping for the spherical entangling surface. One of the things I said, or I may not have said, but it was on the transparency, is that we're thinking about a Euclidean path integral now. And so we can think about the Euclidean version of this conformal mapping. In that case, on one side, in the thermal bath, we have S1 cross the hyperbolic plane, and the conformal mapping gives us RD. And so it's really a one-to-one map. This space gets mapped to cover this entire space here. If, on the other hand, I go to other temperatures, I stick this extra factor of n in there, so I'm increasing the periodicity of this S1, I get an n-fold cover of my RD. And so that's precisely the n-fold cover that the replica trick required. And so we're really, by going back to flat space through the conformal mapping, we're seeing that there's this twist operator that lives on our spherical entangling surface. And so how can we make use of that? Well, what we can do is we can calculate this correlator by simply mapping from the thermal bath back to flat space. And we'll see what that expression is. So here's my conformal mapping. On that side, what I have, this is just the expectation value of the stress tensor in my thermal bath. That's just a uniform or constant stress tensor. What makes this correlator interesting is the rest of the conformal map. In particular, that's going to be singular at the boundary of the space or near the twist operator. And so the singularities appearing here appear because of these factors. the stress tensor isn't quite conformal primary, and so there's always this annoying anomalous bit that appears here that I presented in a certain way. But we can figure out what that anomalous bit is. It's just the stress tensor at this, well, magic temperature T naught. And the reason I know that is because when n equals 1, there is no twist operator. It's just flat, empty space. And so these terms have to cancel. And there's a comment here. You might compare these kinds of calculations to a recent calculation that Don did with his friend.
Sorry, I know I've been urged.
Okay. As long as Sean doesn't urge me to shut up.
The whole point of this maneuver here is that we have a two-point function that we need to calculate.
Yep.
And we don't exactly know what, if we wanted to use holography, we didn't know what would be the corresponding fluctuation for that twist operator that we have there.
Related
to expectation values of stress tensor that you could calculate using gravity.
Yeah, I would have said it slightly stronger. Which is that if I didn't have this conformal mapping, I would have known where to start with that.
But
for these, we haven't even done gravity. This is conformal field theory. For these spherical surfaces, we have this conformal mapping. And so this magic formula applies for any conformal field theory. As long as the...
anticipating that that's where gravity is going to come, on the right-hand side. Because
it's certainly true, yes. Okay, so let's carry on. Now we go holographic. But, well, the point is, actually, this isn't even holographic. The point is that, you know, I see some singularities in this correlator. What I had before was a planar twist, or what I want to find is the leading singularity. So I pick that off, and I can read off this particular coefficient. From this formula, I can see that that coefficient has some stuff in here, but it's essentially just the difference of the energy density in the thermal bath. That's still not holography, but we can make it a holographic formula. Let's try Gauss-Bonnet gravity. We get some messy expression like that. So unfortunately, it doesn't seem like there's, for this particular coefficient or this magic weight that characterizes the twist operators, it doesn't seem like there's going to be any universal expression in higher dimensions the way there was in 2. And again, if we work harder, we can see that it's not just the central charges that determine these expressions, but there's also other data in the CFT that fixes those. So I've run over. Here are some slogans. I'll thank you for indulging me with an extra 5 minutes. I'll let you read the slogans, and that's it.
So we can't do like mutual information or something?
Sorry, again?
Like mutual information or disjoint intervals. Unfortunately, this mapping doesn't allow us to do that.
Yeah, no, you have to work harder. You know, there's some calculations the spheres were very, very special. There are some calculations we started doing for mutual information, but there's not some beautiful derivation like this.
And it's actually CFT data. This is like spectrum of operator dimension.
I could have said, you know, was it so surprising that other stuff came in there? Well, you know, the Cardi-Calabresi result is for sort of the simplest possible entanglement entropy. We already know that if they have disjoint intervals, that you have to start to know about the entire spectrum of the CFT. All sorts of junk comes into it. Just to finish my train of thought, I might have hoped that you know, this was a single interval or a single connected region, and that there was going to be a simple expression. Perhaps that was a naive hope.
Why do you want it to be a universal formula? Why do you want to calculate the system? So if it depends on more properties of the system, it's all the better. You just have to learn the spectrum.
Okay, absolutely. But
something that was universal and didn't depend on anything, say just the dimension.
Okay. Okay. So I have an attitude problem. I agree that you know, there's lots of, it says that there's lots of interesting information in that, but then the question is, how do I extract it? And And at present, I don't have.
When the entropy gives you
the spectrum. Sure. In principle, with the rainy interim, I've got all sorts of information there, and there's.
Well, you were looking for something which didn't have much. I mean, you found something which has been.
Okay.
What I can get out of it is that. What can you get out of it?
No, I'm pointing at the guy sitting behind you.
It's easier to calculate.
I don't know, I've got some it's all theoretical calculation. It's fun, but what do you learn from it?
So from the...
Well,
you can still like connect it this published by algebra. I mean, the constant part is the velocity in the universe.
Right, you can use the full spectrum. Sometimes it's super complicated.
Yeah, no, we said that already.
But, I was asking about what insight does it give you to the physics of the system?
Well, if you calculate Rainy entropy for a large n, you can get the law lying.
N goes to infinity, it takes out the graph space.
You take out the, like, something like low energy space.
Yeah.
Like
it's like zero temperature.
Right. Yeah, well, there wasn't time today, but there's some discussion of that in the paper. And you can match the degeneracy of the ground state, of course, turns out to be the entropy of zero temperature in the thermal problem. There are these inequalities that I didn't talk about. So the S2 bounds the entanglement entropy. If I don't know how to calculate the entanglement entropy by calculating S2, I've got a bound on the entanglement entropy. Yeah. Right, and that's what you kind of saw in that graph, that there was the graph. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Then, in terms of, like,
idiosyncrasies,
there are more fields around.
You're asking me? You mean on the holographic context or in general? Or?
On the holographic context. Maybe you would think that the original formulas are probably they have to be modified. Like, you have B fields on the background. Or.
If I have what field?
Some other gravity mode.
Yeah, no. I mean, something you can think about are G flows, and we've started, or other people have started to think about that. There is a new set of universal terms. You know, I showed you this fancy formula where you had central charges multiplied by geometry. If you have an RG flow, there's now new dimensionful stuff in the problem, and in certain cases, you get extra or new universal coefficients that sort of mix the geometry in these. Dimensionful coefficients.
As expected, it's richer. That's
okay. Sorry?
So it's richer in that sense.
Yeah, there's more information there.
Plus the map that you did at the beginning, we can choose some position dependent cutoff or something. The map to the hyperbola, if it's not a zero.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a zero. Sure. So now you have a cutoff for the expansion space.
Yeah, I know. The discussion I was having was I'd gone back to Rune and Takanagi and calculated there. But. This derivation, yeah, well, it would be interesting to see what we can do with this derivation. First, perturbing the shape, but also perturbing the underlying quantum or conformal field theory as well.
Any more questions?